Well, it's hard to believe that this was 21 years ago that this happened, but back in 2004, I don't know how many remember, the world kind of watched in horror as this massive tsunami swept across the Indian Ocean, and it ended up being devastating. And there's all sorts of stories, incredible stories that came out of that, but one sticks out to me. It was the story of a small fishing boat with 8 Indonesian fishermen on it. The morning or the day started off, I'm sure, ordinarily enough for them. It was calm water, clear skies, and I know tsunamis are not weather events, they're geological events, but and just kind of that familiar rhythm of the waves hitting the boat, and then everything changed. The horizon began to, change. And not just a subtle change. It went from being something out there on the in the distance to a 100-foot wall of water that was bearing down on them. And they faced what really, I mean, anybody else in that situation, like, we're not getting out of this. This is certain death. And they made a decision in that moment that, to me, defies all human logic. If it would have been me on that boat, well, I probably wouldn't have been conscious, so I wouldn't have been able to make this decision. But had I been conscious and able to make the decision, I would have turned the boat and ran from the wave. That's not what they did. They turned that boat toward the wall of water, revved up the engines, and went straight for it. And amazingly, while so many thousands of people died in the water and on the shore, these 8 Indonesian fishermen survived the tsunami, and they did it by heading into what looked like was their certain death. I don't know how many of you have ever felt, maybe not quite that dramatic, but you felt trapped, like there was no way out, almost like you've got a 100-foot wall of water coming at you. Your thoughts are racing, your anxiety is starting to go through the roof. You cry out for help, you try to plan, you try to strategize, but that wall just keeps coming at you. And somewhere in the midst of all of the turmoil and confusion, this desperate question pops into your soul. Where is God in all of this? Why is this happening? As I said, we're starting a new series this morning entitled Waves, and we're going to look at a few stories from Scripture that have to do with either literal storms, or as a story we're going to look at today is kind of a figurative storm. A story that comes from the book of Exodus, chapter 14, because if anybody in the history and the stories of Scripture knows what it's like to be between a wall of water and something that they could not escape, it was the Israelites in Exodus chapter 14. Of course, the difference between the Israelites facing what they were facing and in the storms that we face in life is that they are coming out of what was really the most remarkable rescue mission in the history of mankind, as God had delivered them from 400 years of slavery in Egypt. Moses, with the help of a few, 10 to be exact, divinely timed and designed plagues, had finally convinced Pharaoh to, oh baby, let my people go. Oh God, you were supposed to finish that. Huh. We're on the verge of VBS. So that's a throwback VBS. And if you don't know that song, you need to look it up. Pharaoh, Pharaoh. I need to work on my jokes while I'm on vacation, apparently. But unfortunately, they hadn't got too far down the road before Pharaoh had another change of heart, and he decides, I can't let these people go. I have to go get them. And so he rounds up his army and sends them after them. Now, to really grasp the situation that the Israelites find themselves in, we need to understand what they were up against. First of all, they were up against the Red Sea, which initially wasn't all that big of a deal because it was just a body of water. And we know that wasn't the easiest route to take. There was probably some questions in their minds about why are we going toward the Red Sea? There's a shorter way out of here. Exodus 13 kind of bears that out, that God sent them this way, even though going a different direction would have been an easier path. And we know now in hindsight why he did that. But it wasn't just the Red Sea. They also had this thing behind them that was coming called the Egyptian army. Now, the Egyptian army, and it's kind of fitting that I'm talking about them a day after we just kind of showed off our army in a parade. The Egyptian army, for its day, was probably, in its context, even mightier than the United States Army, which I know is hard to imagine. They were at the pinnacle of civilization, technologically, military. I mean, they had it all. And really, the crowning achievement of their military were these engineering marvels called chariots. The chariots were built, they were lightweight, but they were sturdy. They were built for speed and stability, and it wasn't just the chariot that you had to deal with. It was the three guys that were on the chariot. There was a driver who had been trained really from childhood on how to maneuver these things and navigate them. There was a shield bearer who was, his responsibility was to hold the big shield up and keep the other two guys on the chariot safe from any oncoming artillery or whatever. And then there was the warrior who had in his possession and was trained to use all of the most advanced weaponry of the day. And it's not just that there were a few of these. At least in this story, there are 600 of these chariots that are sent to bring these Israelites back. And it's not just them. There's also all sorts of other soldiers on horseback and all of these things that are coming to gather these Israelites and bring them back to Egypt. And who were the Israelites in the story? Well, they were people who had just been recently released from slavery after 400 years. That was a ragtag group of people. All they had known was brutal oppression. They didn't have any military experience. They didn't have any weapons. They didn't have any combat training, nothing like that. Most of, if not all of them, were on foot. The ones who weren't on foot were probably because they were too small or too old to walk and somebody was helping them along. So you can just imagine this mass of humanity that's walking out of Egypt with no experience. In fact, they don't even really know what's in front of them. They don't know what's coming because they're leaving everything that they have known. And they find themselves quite literally between an impossible obstacle, the Red Sea, and an unstoppable force, the Egyptian army. And this is where we pick up the story in Exodus 14, and we're going to read this in a couple of chunks. But Exodus 14, verses 10 through 14 says this. As Pharaoh approached, the people of Israel looked up and panicked when they saw the Egyptians overtaking them. They cried out to the Lord, and they said to Moses, "Why did you bring us out here to die in the wilderness? Weren't there enough graves for us in Egypt? What have you done to us? Why did you make us leave Egypt? Didn't we tell you this would happen while we were still in Egypt? We said, 'Leave us alone. Let us be slaves to the Egyptians. It is better to be a slave in Egypt than a corpse in the wilderness.' But Moses told the people, 'Don't be afraid. Just stand still and watch the Lord rescue you today. The Egyptians you see today will never be seen again. The Lord himself will fight for you. Just stay calm.'" Easy for Moses to say. Actually, it might not have been very easy for Moses to say. But this passage gives us a raw, kind of unfiltered look at the psychology of a people in crisis. And if there were ever a people in crisis, it's the nation of Israel at this moment. Notice the progression of their reaction. They looked up and panicked. Now, the Hebrew word there is not just, oh, like being briefly startled. No, they freaked out. I don't know if there's a Hebrew word for that, but if there was, that's what it would be. It's this horrified realization. And you can just try to picture it. You're walking along. You're exhausted. You've just been set free. You're still trying to work all this out in your mind that you have freedom now, so you're hopeful. You still don't know what the journey looks like ahead. You finally escape the nightmare, and then you hear this distant, ominous rumble way behind you, and you try to convince yourself, you know, well, there's a couple of tribes that they're always late to everything. That's probably them running to catch up, And then you see the dust cloud and you think, well, maybe it's a, you know, there's always dust storms, and you're trying to talk yourself into it not being what you think it is. And then you start seeing the sun, start the glint of the sun on all of the chariot wheels that are flying across the desert towards you. And the very army that has haunted your nightmares for centuries is in hot pursuit to bring you back to slavery or worse. And you can relate to the response that the Israelites have. After they realize what's happening, they do two things, and it's funny, they do two things almost simultaneously. They cry out to the Lord, and almost as if they want to make sure that God hears them and Moses hears them, they turn on Moses. They say, "What's going on? You brought us out here in the middle of nowhere. We could have died in Egypt. And now you've brought us out here for what? For the same thing? To be killed? Weren't there enough graves in Egypt for us to just die back there?" You just stop and think, I mean, how often do we kind of do sort of the same thing? We have something that there's something good that's happening in our lives, and we run into an obstacle, and we cry out to the Lord while simultaneously looking for the next person, the first person we can throw under the bus to blame for all of the bad things that are happening. That's what the Israelites are doing to Moses and to God in this moment. And their words, they just drip with sarcasm. Was it because there were no graves in Egypt? Now, you stop and think about that. What is one of the things historically that Egypt has been most well known for? Their pyramids. Do you know what pyramids are? They're tombs. That's not to say the Israelites were going to be buried in pyramids, but at least we know that there were probably plenty of graves in Egypt. So the question is a really kind of sarcastic one that they're throwing at Moses. They're just saying, if we're going to die anyway, why couldn't we have died back in Egypt around our family members where we could get a proper burial? You brought us out here to be buzzard food. And you could almost be sympathetic with Moses if he were to just throw down his staff, look at God and say, you know what? I'm done with these people before we even get started. They're yours. But he doesn't. And this is where really we see the spiritual leader. We see how far Moses has come in his life, because the spiritual leadership, it just shines here. As he looks at them and he says, don't be afraid. Just stand still and watch the Lord rescue you. The Egyptians that you see today, they will never be seen again. That's a confident thing to say. The Lord himself will fight for you. Just stay calm. That phrase there, stand still, it communicates something more than just a physical, just stopping. What Moses is communicating to them is, stop, put your lives in God's hands, the one who has the authority, the power. You've just seen what he can do. Just stand still and watch him work. And it makes sense that he has to tell them to stay calm, because after he says all of this other stuff, I'm sure that they're starting to get a little bit tense. It's a posture of expectant trust that Moses is calling the people to, not paralyzed in action. And what's so significant about this moment and about what Moses says is that it's communicating some powerful truths to the people of Israel at the moment, but it also points forward to a greater deliverance that's to come. Just as the Israelites faced an enemy that they were utterly incapable of doing anything about, we face a couple of enemies that on our own, we have no power whatsoever to deal with: sin and death. There is no human ingenuity, there's no human willpower, there is no human strength that can do anything about sin and death. On our own, we are powerless against sin and death. But just as God miraculously fought for Israel, and didn't just fight for Israel, won decisively The Egyptians that they saw that day were never seen again. Jesus did the exact same thing on the cross and through his resurrection. He defeated sin and death so much that they literally do not have to have any power, dominion, or authority in our lives. Again, I like to say this, Jesus killed death. So what does that mean for us here and now? Because we all face our 100-foot walls of water. We all face our advancing armies. It means that fear is real, but God's power is greater. Let me give a couple of examples. When you're facing financial collapse, when you're facing the fear of losing everything, remember, God's power is greater than your spreadsheet. God is far richer than your bank account. And he is far more generous than you could ever imagine. The same God who fed millions of people miraculously in the wilderness for generations can absolutely provide for your needs. Now, I will tell you, that provision might not always look like what you expect. Just like God's rescue didn't probably look like what the Israelites were going to expect. Or when you're facing a terrifying medical diagnosis and a prognosis that seems like a death sentence, remember, God's power supersedes any medical opinion. The God who spoke the universe into existence, the God who divided the very seas, is certainly capable of intervening in the cells of your body, of bringing healing that defies human understanding. When you're facing broken relationships, when you're facing hurt and resentment that don't seem like you can ever bridge, remember God's power to restore is far greater than any human capacity to destroy. The one who reconciled the entire world to himself through Christ can certainly bring reconciliation, healing, and even deeper connection in your fractured relationships. And I know there are some of you that need to hear that today. Or when you feel caught in the relentless grip of something that feels impossible to break, remember, God's power to deliver is stronger than any physical or psychological bondage. The God who shattered the power of Pharaoh, the most powerful ruler of his time, can absolutely break any stronghold in your life. And he can lead you to freedom and wholeness. So while the fear that we experience in these moments is real and really at times valid, it makes sense that the Israelites were a little scared in this moment. Don't ever let that fear supersede the realization that God's power is greater than anything you face. Continuing in the story, verses 15 through 22. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Why are you crying out to me? Tell the people to get moving. Pick up your staff and raise your hand over the sea. Divide the water so the Israelites can walk through the middle of the sea on dry ground. And I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they will charge in after the Israelites. My great glory will be displayed through Pharaoh and his troops, his chariots and his charioteers. When my glory is displayed through them, all Egypt will see my glory and know that I am the Lord." Then the angel of God, who had been leading the people of Israel, moved to the rear of the camp. The pillar of cloud also moved from the front and stood behind them. The cloud settled between the Egyptian and Israelite camps. As darkness fell, the cloud turned to fire, lighting up the night. But the Egyptians and Israelites did not approach each other all night. Then Moses raised his hand over the sea, and the Lord opened up a path through the water with a strong east wind. The wind blew all that night, turning the seabed into dry land. So the people of Israel walked through the middle of the sea on dry ground with walls of water on each side. There's kind of a fascinating but overlooked moment right at the beginning of this scene. The people have been crying out to God, which seems like a very natural and theologically correct thing to do. You find yourself in trouble, you cry out to God, right? But God's immediate response to that is somewhat surprising. Why are you crying out to me? Tell the Israelites to get moving. Now, on the surface, that sounds harsh. It sounds like a rebuke, but it's not really. God's not really rebuking them for crying out. He's wanting them to put their trust and their faith into action. It's kind of the same thing that many of us do where we're well-intentioned, but sometimes we'll use prayer as an excuse to not do certain things. Well, we're just waiting on God. When in reality, we know the next thing that we're supposed to do, we're just not willing to do it. God is calling the Israelites to say, okay, you've seen what I did back in Egypt, right? You've seen all these things? You can cry out to me, but you already know what I'm capable of. Get moving. Start putting your faith into action. But again, think about what God is asking them to do. For the ancient, not just the Egyptians, but many of the cultures around there at that time, crossing the sea was a practically impossible thing. There was a reason that Egyptian maritime technology was only built to navigate the Nile River, because the sea represented chaos. It represented danger, likely even death. And so even the Egyptians and all of their might and strength, they didn't want to have anything to do with the sea. And that's a cultural kind of attitude that I'm sure the Israelites picked. I mean, they'd been there for 400 years, so they had to be influenced somewhat by the people that were around them. And here is God calling them to move toward the chaos. If the chaos behind them was not bad enough, God's telling them to step into this, not just a physical obstacle, but an emotional, mental, spiritual obstacle. He's calling them to step into the unknown, to defy what seemed naturally impossible to them. Now, he does part the sea, but it's interesting how he does it, because when they start moving forward, he doesn't do it automatically. It comes in stages. And there's some lessons for us to learn in each stage of this. First, there's that command to move. He's not going to do anything until the Israelites show that they're willing to move forward. He doesn't part the sea and then tell them to go. He tells them to go, and then he will part the sea. Again, telling them to move what looks like, as those Indonesian fishermen did, what looks like certain destruction, which is so often the pattern of faith, that we have to take the initial step to start walking what seems like an impossibility before we see the miraculous provision. We have to take the initial step before we see the miraculous provision. That's what God is calling the Israelites to do. And then Moses is instructed to take his staff, stretch it out over the water, and it will part. Now that staff is just an ordinary piece of wood, but it has become a very significant thing in Moses' hand. We've already seen what it was capable of in the plagues. He's worked a few miracles with it. But you realize that staff is only just, again, an ordinary piece of wood until it is raised in obedience. And I can't help but think of all of the ordinary things that God puts in our hands that we think there's just no way that God can do something with it, until we say, well, if you can do it, if anybody can do anything with this, it's you. And we raise it in obedience and we just are amazed at what God did with that thing. That's Moses' staff in this story. It's only then, after the command to move and the Israelites starting to move forward and the act of obedience and raising Moses' staff, that the waters actually part. And the text tells us that God sends a wind from the east that literally blows a channel through the water and blows so hard that the water stacks up on either side and dries the ground out. And this wasn't just a lucky kind of moment in the season where the water was low and the Israelites could walk across. If you're familiar with the name Josh McDowell, he told a story about a debate that he was in, or a discussion that he was in, and he was talking about the Red Sea, and the guy that he was talking to was saying, well, this would have been in the dry season, the water wouldn't have been that high, might have been 6 inches deep, and so, you know, it's logical that the people would have been able to walk across. And Josh McDowell just starts laughing. He says, man, that is incredible. And the guy thought he had him, and Josh McDowell goes, man, that is amazing that God drowned the entire Egyptian army in 6 inches of water. So this was God literally blowing the water apart and then drying the ground out. God was demonstrating his power over creation itself. The same God who separated the waters in Genesis 1 is showing what he is still capable of. He's now separating them to create a pathway of salvation and freedom for his people. This is creation language that's being used in the story. He's not just making a different way. He is creating a whole new way where there never had been a way before. And just think about what it would have taken for the Israelites to take that first step onto the seabed. The water is towering on either side of you. I can't even fathom. My best picture of this is Charlton Heston walking across, you know, and even that was impressive with the technology they had. When was that made? Back in the 50s? They didn't even have that technology back in ancient Egypt. They couldn't even manufacture this. This had to have been God. But the wall standing, these walls of water standing up on each side. And every step you take is just another step of trust that this water is not going to collapse on you while you're walking across. And every step you take, you realize the ground is bone dry. There's no mud. There's no muck. This is incredible. But it takes a lot of courage to take those steps, to keep moving forward. And really, the major miracle in this, and it's not just the parting of the Red Sea, it was the fact that 2 million Israelites found the courage to not only start the journey, but keep going all the way through to the other side. It's hard to get 50 people today to agree on one thing, let alone 2 million people to follow the same path. And again, the amazing, they're walking on dry ground. So what that tells us is God didn't just make a way, he made a good way. He made a way that was more than enough for his people to get through to the other side. Sometimes we mistakenly believe that if God is going to call us into something, it's always going to be hard. The path is always going to be difficult. And sometimes that's the case. But how many times do we take that first step of faith and we realize, God prepared the way much better than I would have ever expected him to do. This way is so much better than what I would have done. That's what God does with the Israelites. The end of the story, verses 23 through 31. Then the Egyptians, all of Pharaoh's horses, chariots, and charioteers, chased them into the middle of the sea. But just before dawn, the Lord looked down on the Egyptian army from the pillar of fire and cloud, and he threw their forces into total confusion. He twisted their chariot wheels, making their chariots difficult to drive. Let's get out of here, away from these Israelites, the Egyptians shouted. The Lord is fighting for them against Egypt. When all the Israelites had reached the other side, the Lord said to Moses, raise your hand over the sea again. Then the waters will rush back and cover the Egyptians and their chariots and charioteers. So as the sun began to rise, Moses raised his hand over the sea, and the water rushed back into its usual place. The Egyptians tried to escape, but the Lord swept them into the sea. Then the waters returned and covered all the chariots and charioteers, the entire army of Pharaoh. All of the Egyptians who had chased the Israelites into the sea, not a single one of them survived. But the people of Israel had walked through the middle of the sea on dry ground, as the water stood up like a wall on both sides. That is how the Lord rescued Israel from the hand of the Egyptians that day. And the Israelites saw the bodies of the Egyptians washed up on the seashore. When the people of Israel saw the mighty power that the Lord had unleashed against the Egyptians, they were filled with awe before him. They put their faith in the Lord and in his servant Moses. There's kind of an ironic twist in this story. You know that military technology that I talked about at the beginning, that daunting chariots, the thing that was supposed to give Egypt the ultimate victory, ended up being the very thing that was their undoing. Those lightweight yet strong vehicles, they were useless in that seabed. Not to mention that God twisted the wheels to make it hard for them to get across. The advanced weaponry that those warriors had couldn't shoot those arrows through the water when it was crashing down on them. The military might they placed their ultimate trust in became their undoing. This was not just a military victory for the Israelites. In fact, you could argue it wasn't a military victory at all because they didn't do a single thing except walk. It was a powerful theological statement. Those 10 plagues that God unleashed on Egypt, do you know what each one of those plagues rendered powerless? Every single one of the Egyptian gods. God made his way through their entire pantheon of gods and said, nope, I'm more powerful. Nope, I'm more powerful. God had systematically demonstrated his absolute power, exposing the futility of the Egyptian gods. And now at the Red Sea, God reveals his ultimate authority over all creation. He defeats Yam. They come up with better names for these gods. Yam was the Egyptian god of the sea. And he defeats him in his own domain. Now we know that those gods are nothing, but he's showing the Egyptian people and the Israelite people, there's nothing that you're going to face that I can't overcome. He humbles Pharaoh, who was considered a living god in his own country, in his land, and he does it before the eyes of both the Egyptians and the Israelites. The scripture tells us that God looked down on the Egyptian army and he threw them into confusion. Again, this is another, the panic that we saw in the Israelites, this is that panic ratcheted up. I mean, this is the Egyptian army freaking out. They turn on each other, they don't know where to go, they get their chariots stuck in the, well, it wasn't mud, it was dry ground. And they end up really, in their panic, destroying themselves as the water comes back over them. The mighty Egyptian army, the terror of the ancient world, was reduced to utter chaos by the one who holds the very seas in the palm of his hand. Think about what that means for us today. When we face those chariots that feel like they're bearing down on us, when we face those walls of water that are coming at us, sometimes those very things that we feel threatened by the most can actually become the place where God shows his greatest power. The financial crisis can become a powerful testimony to God's supernatural provision, showing others that he is indeed the ultimate provider. The terrifying medical diagnosis can become an unexpected story of miraculous healing, pointing people to the great physician. The seemingly irreparable broken relationship can become a powerful witness to the transformative and reconciling power of God's love. The seemingly unbreakable chains of addiction can become a platform for a powerful ministry to others who are still in bondage, demonstrating the liberating power of Christ. And notice something significant about this thing that God does for the Israelites. God doesn't just deliver his people away from their enemies. He actively fights for them. Moses had told them, the Lord himself will fight for you. Basically saying without saying it, you guys, God's going to take care of this. He'll fight your battle. You just get moving. And I think that's the message for many of us that we need to hear this morning. We need to let go of our own conceptions of what's possible. Because I can imagine in that moment, those 2 million Israelites, they're looking at the Red Sea, they're looking at the Egyptian army, and they're thinking, we're done. They needed to let go of what they thought was going to happen and trust God. We need to let go of our frantic attempts to control the situation, of our need for credit. And we need to do it so that we can witness God's power at work. And I think this is where so many of us struggle. We say we trust God, but we keep one hand firmly on the situation, just in case he doesn't come through the way we expect him to. And I think this is probably a good time to remind some of us of the ashes that we let go during Lent. We pray for God's intervention, but we're also busy crafting our own plans for escape. We ask for his guidance, but we keep our own map close at hand. True faith, the kind of faith that these Israelites, that Moses exhibited, that allows God to work most powerfully, it often means letting go completely and surrendering our need to control and watching as he moves. The text culminates with the complete and utter destruction of the Egyptian army. It says, then the waters returned and covered all the chariots and charioteers. The entire army of Pharaoh, of all the Egyptians who had chased the Israelites into the sea, not a single one survived. That is total victory. If you ever played Mortal Kombat, you win one of the fights. Flawless victory. That's the thing that pops into my head when I think about that. There was no enemy left to regroup. There was no lingering threat. Because when God fights for you, he fights completely and decisively. We see that in the victory that Jesus won on the cross. It wasn't just a partial victory. It was a complete and finished work. He said it himself. It is finished. And that means exactly that. The power of sin and death has been definitely, decisively, and completely defeated. But the crossing of the Red Sea wasn't the end of Israel's story. In many ways, it was just the beginning, because they're going to run into more obstacles. This was just the beginning of them seeing the faithfulness and the power of God at work. They're going to face many more daunting challenges in the wilderness. They're going to face many more tests of their faith. But from that moment forward, they will always be able to look back to what God has done. They will always be able to look back and remember, our God makes a way where there seems to be no way. You know, some of those choruses we sing, we think, oh, that's nice. No. That might be one of the most powerful. God will make a way where there's, I'm not going to sing it, where there seems to be no way. He works in ways we cannot see. He might make a way for me. No, he will make a way for me. And today, as we start this series, I don't know what kind of Red Sea you might be standing in front of. I don't know what kind of enemy might be bearing down on you. I don't know how impossible the situation looks, but I want you to hold on to three truths that this story teaches us. First, your fear is real. It's understandable. But God's power is infinitely greater. Those Israelites weren't wrong to be terrified. I'm not going to fault them for that. I would have been, yeah. But Pharaoh's army wasn't going to have the last word. The Red Sea was not going to have the last word. Whatever overwhelming situation you are facing today, it's real. It's significant, but it is never greater than your God. Second, faith, I got often, but I'm going to say almost always, requires movement before miracle. The Red Sea did not part until after the Israelites started moving toward it. The next time they cross a body of water, there's somebody has to physically get in the water before it parts. It didn't part until Moses raised his staff in obedient faith. So while God might be calling you to do something that seems completely illogical, you want me to walk toward that chaos? He's calling you because he's got a plan to get you through the chaos. You got to take the first step. You got to take the next right step. I had that written earlier in my sermon. I skipped right over it. What act of obedience is God calling you to do? What step is he waiting for you to take? And third, and this might be the most encouraging thing, and we don't discover this till after the fact many times. God will not just deliver you from your enemies. He will actively fight for you. We need to get out of our minds that God sends us on these wild goose chases, waiting for us to come back to him to tell him how we did. He's way out ahead of you. He's already working things before he's even called you to take the step. He is actively fighting for you. He's actively fighting for me. And when he wins, it will not be a half victory. It will be decisive. It's already been decisive. You are not in this battle alone. The same God who looked down on the Egyptian army and threw them into confusion is actively at work in your situation right now, even if you can't see it. And remember this, that parting of the Red Sea, that wasn't God's final act of deliverance. Just as he made a way through the water for Israel, God made the ultimate way through the very depths of death itself, through the cross and the resurrection of Christ. So whatever sea you're facing today, I want to tell you that God is still in the business of making a way, not only where there seems to be no way, maybe where there has never, ever been a way before. Amen. Would you pray with me?